Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Midweek Takeaway. Today we're joined by our friend Colin Bird. How are you doing, Colin?
I'm doing fine, thank you very much. How's you too?
All good here, yeah, all good. It's spring, it feels very good to get out and actually get some sunshine on our face. I know it doesn't really quite, you know, appropriate to you guys being in wherever you are in the world where it's pretty much sunny all year round, but certainly in the UK, it's a rare occasion that the sun is actually out.
That's right, that's something new and something to be enjoyed. Those winters can be very long, can't they? Lots of rain. I think not even the rain, it's the greyness what got to me a lot.
So how's things then? I mean, it's been quite a few reports on your companies, but before we talk about those specifically, do you want to go through commodity prices really in things like the copper space? Obviously, we've talked at length about copper in the past, but also lithium and nickel and other elements that seem to be moving to all-time highs right now.
Well, we've got this, you know, as we all know, the world knows, we've got this dreadful war, or no, let's call it a war, call it an invasion. And that's offset things. And I guess that unless you believe in Armageddon, there'll be a fix. And I'm pretty sure there'll be a fix. And I don't want to be the eternal optimist, but I think there'll be a fix this week in the form of a ceasefire and a solution. I mean, Mr. Putin needs an out. Or given that out, I don't know, but I suppose it will be the Chinese. And I see, you know, I see a solution to this before weekend, quite frankly. And the carnage can't continue. But conversely, Putin's in a corner and there's got to be some sort of a resolution where some sort of face is saved. But back to, you know, your question, I mean, we are in difficult times. We've been in difficult times for years. There's also always some geopolitical situation on the boundary stopping things. But you've got to look at mankind. Where is mankind going? It's basically going apace. Everybody wants their fridges. Everybody wants their cars, the second cars. Everybody wants a nice home. The markets are emerging and coming out of this COVID-19. And then there's a thirst, you know, the recognition that our planet is under extreme pressure in terms of climate, and that it wouldn't be nice to do things. Things have to be done. And then, of course, you get the contrarians, you know, between hydrocarbons and all the renewables. But there's no doubt in my mind there's an unstoppable inertia behind motivation, momentum behind copper. I think, you know, everybody wants to talk about 15, 16,000. I really don't. And, you know, like all commodities and cycles, you may see some 8,500. But you're not going to see any 5,000. And anybody who's getting 8,000, 8,500 for a copper show where the grades are reasonable are going to do extremely well for the foreseeable future. And of course, I made that comment and make it regularly about the day of the small miner is back, because those big properties, they take forever to develop. And a lot of them now are in difficult jurisdictions. We saw nickel last week. Fingers were burnt there because, you know, I guess a few individuals or one in particular went short on nickel, and then we had that outrageous $100,000. Of course, that's not real. That's just not real and can't be taken seriously. But again, nickel, I think you've got to pencil $20,000, and that's sustainable, and it's sustainable for a long time. Lithium, as we all know, is if you've got a lithium project in one of the companies as now, that is there's certainly a stack of legs there. I'm a great believer in vanadium as well, because I think I've said to you, you know, that it's okay to have the ability to for this these wind turbines, solar cells. But of course, when the sun goes out and the wind goes down, they stop turning. So the ability to store energy is very important. And the winners there are going to be vanadium. Already we're seeing the emergence of the vanadium flow battery, a storage battery. Likewise, zinc seems it might take a play, and of course, manganese. And so we're into all of those metals. And Ukraine's, I don't know. Maybe I am the eternal optimist, Phil, because I believe that Ukraine has been the world's wake-up.
Sure.
How long, you know, I mean, even before the Second World War, Chamberlain was saying peace in our time, and everybody was saying this will never happen, you know, in 2022, and it happened, didn't it?
Yeah.
And I think there'll be a world order wake up, but these geopolitical issues that you get, you cannot time into the general demand. The general demand, as we're seeing, the recovery post-COVID, the commodity demand, we're going to see the day of the miner as well as the day of the small miner. We're going to see the day of the miner. So I'm, you know, this despite this setback, I'm seeing very, 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 very good run for natural resource companies, big, small, and little for that matter.
I think you're right. It highlights our demand, the our dominance or the Russian dominance and our dependence on Russia for, and also the Ukraine as well, for a lot of harvest and foods. Of these things, like a third of foods that come into Europe are from the Ukraine. So really this war is just highlighting how much we have a dependence on other countries, and we need to go to our, you know, become more self-sufficient in our quest for natural resources, for commodities. You know, look to English registered or British registered companies, like some of them that you run for our metals.
Exactly. And I think we've got to be friends as well. You know, Trump in his first term started his protectionism, and you know, individual countries looking after themselves, as you say. But you know, it's fine, it's a nice concept, but you can't. I mean, China really is short of a lot of metals and has to go out for them. So I think we need a friendlier world. I think we need free trade. I don't think we need all of these battles about you're doing me over and saying that, you know, I think we really do need a new world order. And I think it's got to be a friendlier world. And I'm optimistic that even China have been sobered a little bit by seeing what happens when you start an invasion. I mean, let's face it, Putin thought this was... I mean, I've never seen tanks. I thought you'd designed the tank, Phil, to go across fields and things. Yeah. And there they are lined up in the highway. So it's fairly obvious to me that Putin thought this was a two-day march in. And he actually, I saw today somewhere that, it, you know, the soldiers were told that they would be very welcome.
Sure.
So how incredible is that? You know, and then all of a sudden people are blowing the tanks up, yeah, trying to lie underneath the tanks. Yeah. And,
You've got to admire.
It's a little bit different to what he thought.
You've got to admire the resolve of the Ukrainian people. I mean, you know, how nationalist and the pride they have. You see crowds in Mariupol and Kherson who are walking in the streets up to these Russian soldiers and chanting at them, "You're not welcome, go home." And there's obviously the odd bit of fire burst, you know, gun burst in the air, as if to say, just watch yourselves, guys. But I mean, they are the bravest nation I've ever seen to stand up to these occupiers, basically. And that's all it is. It's an occupation. It's equivalent to what we saw in the Second World War with you know, Hitler occupying Poland. You know, they make no bones about it. This is something that we would never thought we would ever see in the 21st century, right?
That's right. It's an invasion. And I don't think some of those kids who are shooting for the Russians have got too much appetite to be shooting either. So, you know, it's crikey, what sort of win, you know, if you went into Kiev tomorrow, what sort of win would that be? Terrorist action in Moscow, terrorist action in St. Petersburg,
Russia
shooting the soldiers in Ukraine, gee whiz.
The Russian are fighting a guerrilla war, and they failed in Afghanistan, and they failed many, many times over the years. They thought they could just waltz in, and as you say, that the Ukrainians would surrender. And you know, fortunately for us, the Ukrainians haven't, because, you know, if Putin gets away with doing this in Ukraine, you know, where's next? Moldova, Poland, you know.
He'll be in Berlin in 2 years' time.
Yeah, exactly. So just moving away from that, because I try not to get too involved in politics in that. Do you know what I mean? Within this sort of share environment, you mentioned lithium there, and one thing that struck me was a recent RNS from Galileo Resources about this option agreement over the lithium projects in Zimbabwe with BC Ventures. Do you want to take us through how big that is and how kind of like the market just hasn't woken up to the fact that this is a very big news piece?
Thank you for that. I think they see the project as somewhat of a greenfield, you know, high level of risk. Odds against us finding anything very low. And how can that be? We've got Kamativa both sides, and Kamativa was a big tin mine And the dumps, Kamatabi, and the dumps have got 0.58% lithium. So if you have any doubt whether the dumps are, the lithium is there, it is there. If you look at Porter, Porter is a commentator, if you like, on all the major and not necessarily major deposits around the world. There's a guy called Porter Geobase, runs a company, and you get good basic descriptions of lithology, what leads to mineralization, mineralization types, all resource types, what's been extracted. You know, and he's quite adamant that in their articles that spodumene, that's the lithium bearing mineral there, that there's an high probability. Well, in fact, he doesn't even care, because I think when that was written, lithium hadn't got much role. But he talks about it quite openly as being part of the pegmatite sequence. They come as on-strike inverted sources. And if you've got 0.58 in dump, some have been lost in process and here, there and everywhere, your in-situ value or your run-of-mine value is probably nearer about 0.7, 0.8 minimum, which means that in terms of pegmatites, you've got really rich hard rock in situ material. So am I bullish? I'm extremely bullish. And as you've read in the papers, there's been a few transactions in Zimbabwe of quite hefty transactions to actually get at the lithium. And so we're next to the biggest mine. It worked for many, many years, tin. Lithium was not regarded as important. We know it's there. And I think it's a tremendous acquisition. And my thought is to take the market by storm. And then, of course, just for good measure, I wasn't going to do a lithium in isolation, because you don't go to country for single projects. It can be very expensive. And so down near Bulawayo, there, these gold projects, and there's a series of mines down there worked by on a small basis. So that's what we do best in the group. We actually join up miners, give them a central facility, not necessarily an expensive one at that. Give them some mine training, get an offtake for the gold. That's plan B, or concurrent plan A and B together, I suppose. But there's a structure which has been clearly recognized by the vendors' advisors. And this is a fault structure. It sticks out very nice with ground geophysics, and we're actually going to fly it. I don't know if you've noticed my style, in the old days, flying properties, geophysics, and junior mining companies was mutually exclusive, and on the money basis. But the cost of flying has gone down. The quality of the information that comes from it has gone up. So quite frankly, guys walking around with a little box around the necks and setting off charges and setting off, putting cables across the ground, quite frankly, you're a bit pagan now. So in 2 or 3 weeks, you get the information you probably get in about 6 months, and it's a much higher quality. So we're going to fly those Bulawayo gold, and we're also getting ground as I speak. We're organizing to get guys on the ground on the lithium projects. So watch the space there for Galileo. And of course, don't forget Luwa Zasabi, that whopping great copper project that we bought on the Congo border on strike from Mufaliria.
Yeah, and you, there was an update on that towards the end of Feb, where there was mentioned about the completion of second payment for 75% interest in that. That's a good milestone, isn't it?
That's right. Well, we paid up. It didn't. We were pretty sure of it before we started, but we went and checked everything out. We've had Addison working for us in London, and I was a bit wary of taking on a big, a major project. And just sinking money into it. And so I'd like nowadays, and keep, harping back to this, the small miner is back, I've got a strong suspicion that there might be an open pit there, And so we've got in the north, the northern side, northwest, there's definitely a pit, 3 to 5 million tons. Now, that's a very nice proposition, Phil, 6 years at 500,000 tons. I don't need 6 years to drill the place out. However, down to 1,250 meters, that's the deepest hole. If you draw a circle around it, you can get well over 50 million tons, and you can start talking about 1.5% to 2%. So You've got the small pit where you actually explore. We really got into it, Phil. We really got into it. Yes. And it's quite evident that the bulk of the exploration was higher up towards this proposed pit. Yeah. And down to the southeast, there's a shortage of information. There's a shortage of information. And so we'll be doing two drill programs, one shallow. Why are we doing a shallow drill program? Well, if you start an open pit, the less you've got to pre-strip, the better. And so the pre-strip was a bit heftier than I liked, about 30 meters. And I had guys in the store sheds the other day, and above this 30-meter cutoff, there'd been no sampling. And our guys have seen visual mineralization. So I'm rather hoping that the pit will be faster to get to ore.
Yeah.
And not only that, the pre-strip won't be barren. So that'll be a big plus and a lot to talk about to the market. I'm sure the market will be very happy about that one.
Yeah.
The contractor operated, of course, we haven't got to go out and buy plant. And then we'll merrily start drilling this for this really big target. Because in this day and age, there's not many majors who would turn the nose up at 50 million tons at 1.7 or better.
You announced that you were making arrangements in the coming week to view the drill core believed to be held at the nearby Mopani copper mine. Is that progressing?
We've been down to Tukalaushi. We've gone through all of that core, and Mopani is next. So, yeah, we're in front of ourselves, actually. We're in front of our prognosis of what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. And we're actually modelling the open pit, modelling it.
Colin, it's a more generic question, but all companies that we've focused on, except for the big play in Extract, which is in Australia, are all in Africa. And people have viewed Africa almost like a political problem risk in the past. Do you see that that's going to start to be reevaluated in the sight of what's now been happening in Europe and, you know, the uncertainties around the world, that actually Africa is possibly less risky than everybody thought?
Well, I try and have a few sayings to address this issue. Is that one, Kevin, there's not too much copper on Regent Street. And then secondly, you know, you've always, and Phil said at the start of this as well, he tries to avoid politics because, you know, they're short cycle of presidents. And on the other hand, this, what we're looking at are 50 and 100 year mines in the bigger picture. So, and then again, never forget today's terrorist is tomorrow. Today's terrorist is tomorrow's president. So you're in a changing world, and quite frankly, Africa, I mean, just look, you know, that Congo mine that bought on stream Robert Friedland's Ivanhoe, their copper mine is belting out copper and cobalt. And so my perception now, that's getting stronger. Zambia's got a new leader, and you know, that did very well under the last one, but it's the promises are that continuity will maintain, and the country will actually build its copper supply, its portion of copper supply, very well. Now, if you look at Africa, let's look at the competition for copper. Chile has just yesterday they inaugurated a new president who says he's going to share the wealth. He's going to nationalize the copper mines, maybe. He's going to not allow certain copper mines to go on the basis of environmental complaints. He's fed up the fact that, you know, it's water is very difficult for these mines, believe it or not, as you get up towards the desert. And so you could have a lot of new royalties, new taxes. Peru is difficult. Panama is difficult. So everywhere you look now, you're seeing difficulties. And, you know, Chile isn't a mean performer. It's 28% of world's copper. So if an hiccup there. And you know, you talk about hiccups in a time when you need a new Escondida, and that's the big mine in Chile. You need one of those every year. So you don't need blips in the existing production while you're trying to find new production. So Africa, Australia, figure work very, very well. And of course, you can't put a great big circle around Africa and say Africa. You know, South Africa's got its problems, but still manages to get through quite nicely. Zambia is doing well. Namibia is a great place to work. And Botswana, of course, has also got its Kalahari deposit with deposits, which is a huge copper belt. So I think Africa is the place to be, especially that eastern and Southern Africa, you know, Zambia, Zimbabwe, South Africa, they're the places to be. They're the places to be. Tanzania, Mozambique. So they're the places to be.
Tell us a little bit about what's happening with Byzant, because obviously you then move over to some stuff that's also going on in Cyprus there as well with Byzant.
Well, Byzant, you know, I'm very pleased with. I mean, why wouldn't I be? That first site we picked for the joint venture in Cyprus alongside Keras has proved it's come up very nicely. There's possibilities. There's realities to deepen the pit of 70 metres or so. The pit can be extended. The dumps and tailings amount to a hell of a lot of copper. And then Martin and team have found the oxide gold cap. And, you know, on that sort of fault, there appears to be a breccia zone, which is quite rich. So, I mean, I for one, couldn't be happier to joint venture with anyone but Keras. I really like what they're doing. I really like their approach to exploration, no-nonsense approach. Martin really gets down to it and into it. And I don't think we're 5 minutes away from start doing mine planning, and we're not 5 minutes away from metallurgical test work. We're actually doing it now to see how the stuff behaves, what sort of recoveries we'll get. If you put the gold and copper together, what sort of gold copper concentrate do you get? Would it not be better to get the gold separately? Would that be too expensive and not sensible? Do you have a big discount for selling the copper gold concentrate? All of those questions, and they're being answered as we're all talking now. Work's been done down in Perth.
What do you think the potential is then that Jubilee are going to jump on board with that thing as well then?
Well, they've signed up for the option, and wherever I walk around, and you guys have done it as well, there's all sorts of dumps. And individually, they're not massive, but collectively, putting a plant in the right place or a couple of plants, or indeed buying an old plant, which is there, the opportunity to treat these dumps is excellent. And you're not looking at 0.25%. You're looking at 0.6, 0.8, 1% copper. So, yes, I'm absolutely sure Jubilee will be there.
What else has Byzant got apart from the Keras Minerals stuff?
Well, I mean, it's really got a very nice portfolio of assets. The manganese, of course. We've just done 3 kilometres of, we've done quite a bit of work down there, and we're happy about that, and we'll be reporting that in the not too distant future. Manganese, battery manganese being a storage battery. So, you know, we're always into all of the right things. So that looked pretty good. But, you know, I've been down to the open Gorup in Namibia, near the coast there in the desert. And boy, that gave me, well, it gave me a shock, to be honest with you. It's a classic example where in 1975, somebody develops a theory. Nobody challenges it. Everybody does their exploration around it. And decides it's good, it's modest, but, you know, it's not what I wanted it to be. I got there and I couldn't believe my eyes, gents. Wherever I looked, I saw potential. I saw the strangest borehole I've ever seen. Goldfields, a shaft 3.5 by 3.5, 140 metres deep, beautifully sunk. Test for the ore body. You know, that's the most expensive borehole I've ever seen in my life. Then I seen clusters of boreholes, which were, you know, to me, not aimed at really examining the project. And then I saw a north and south limbs, if you like. And I've developed a theory that it's a kind of a big boat-shaped thing. And it's, gee whiz, the potential for finding a big property and a real resource of contained copper, I think, is absolutely tremendous. And it blew my mind away. It really did. We're continuing with our small mine concept because we've got a very large exploration property on our hands. And so we'll be putting a permit in, as I've said before, in April. But we'll be embarking upon quite a large exploration program. Because, you know, these companies who were there before, they only targeted their exploration at 150 metres plus. They were convinced that there would be oxides above that, and they couldn't treat the oxides, of course, in the 70s. But, you know, we put this program in and of shallow drilling, and we did about 500 or 600 metres around Gove. We've done Dupree, the Dupree Trench, and we've done the dome. So quite frankly, you know, those results have yet to come out. But I think we're going to be able to add to this resource in the short term. We're going to get our application in for a mine in the shorter term. And I think Open Gorup is a, you know, it's a tremendous acquisition that the company's got. We're all waiting for that MPSA in the Philippines, of course. There's a porphyry with, I think it's 1.4 million tons of copper and 4.75 million ounces of gold. Not many of those around in the world proven up. And we're waiting for our MPSA, and hopefully we'll be getting it in the not-too-distant future. So Byzant is very, very nicely poised.
The one actually that I'm most excited is the wrong word, but is African Pioneer. You've got two majors. You've got a potential mine individual through African Pioneer as well. And it's still valued at, I think, what is it, £4 million or something, £4.5 million. This seems bizarre in my view. So what do you think, Colin?
Well, looking for adjectives, I think you've hit it. Probably that's the right one. It is bizarre. Those exploration projects that in Zambia that First Quantum have got are huge, absolutely huge. And there is a very strong suggestion that in one of them, that the geology is a lot like over the border in the Congo. So people are cobalt experts, a cobalt bullish for the area. And then that sort of artisan explorers have actually found cobalt traces and cobalt outcrops there. So we're very, very bullish with that. And of course, First Quantum have the benefit of a long, long history before the Chinese took the project. There was a kind of a bit of a hoo-ah, and they lost the project. They were delighted because, you know, they worked with me before, and they were delighted when we got the project, and of course were even more delighted to work with us. So they start from not a zero knowledge base, scratching their heads. This is drill ready. So as you say, it is bizarre when you've got a drill ready, probably the largest tract of ground on traditional copper belt, or even the copper belt the other side in the Congo, where copper values and cobalt values are much higher. For that to be sat in a £4 million, £5 million pound company, is there's no better word than bizarre. Then you look at the Kalahari there, of course, we've got the benefit of that. And African Pioneer have got a deal with Sandfire, which with success gets us an £80 million payout, between zero and £80 million payout. But there's already two holes on that area from past work, which shows the presence of the typical model, i.e. quite steeply dipping, 5 to 10 meters thick with a couple of percent of copper. So there's, you know, so you've got Sandfire Resources who just bought that mine in Spain for about $1.9 billion. You've got First Quantum who's bought a mine off a group I was the managing chief executive of, and we know well known to each other, and it's not very far from the Sentinel mine. So in actual fact, you know, if you look at what we're doing in Zambia with First Quantum, there's a plan B there, because if it doesn't justify a mine, if you find something which is big but not big enough to justify its own mine, and that often happens, you know, then plan B says that you can concentrate it and you know, sort of upgrade it and take the stuff across the Sentinel. And that mine that we found at Kiwara is now the world's 14th biggest mine, and it's producing $250 million worth of profits a quarter. So that's the sort of stuff that, you know, we found in the past. So I've got a very good group of people. Most of that team are in and around the company still. So you're right, Kevin. It's and then, of course, it's got its own mine in the Masters Copper Belt, which it's put the application in for, and we're talking to people with surrounding small operations. So it's the day of the small miner is back. It's probably going to have its own life as a small miner. So there you are, two whopping great exploration projects, and the chance of a small mine in the not too distant future, I don't know, 5,000, 7,000, 8,000 tons of copper per annum. That's one hell of a package for $5 billion, isn't it?
It is, or £5 million, but I mean...
Sorry, I said dollars.
Yeah, yeah, yes, of course. Yeah, yeah. But basically, there really is three projects that each individual project should be worth way more than the market cap of that company. I mean, me and Phil have both said that we really think this should be, you know, a 10 bagger in the making, if there is such a thing. It's like any of those three companies do well, or not three companies, three prospects do well, and it's going to absolutely fly, this one, I think.
I challenge people in the past to find me a main market, small cap, or even nano cap, you know, sub 10 million, that's got option agreements / JVs with two majors, you know, in the form of Sunfire and First Quantum, and also Sunfire holding 15% of the company's, you know, the company stock as well, and some world-class assets in the form of Ongombo, and obviously the mine. You know, look at how close the Zambia project is to the Sentinel mine, right? We've talked about the Sentinel mine in the past, Colin, right?
Yeah, and of course, Sunfire didn't take a 15% stake in the company because they liked us. They like what we're doing in Southern Africa.
I'm sure they like you, Colin. Let's be honest.
Let's hope they like us as well. But
I mean, that's the Kalahari Copper Belt, isn't it? Do you want to talk us through what they're actually doing there already? That they have some.
Yeah, well, they're building this mine. You know, they bought the mine. I think it was from a company called Mod. They paid $167 million to buy T3. I think is around about 100 million tons of 0.98. They then 0.98, you know, it's between a rock and a hard place. It doesn't blow the lights out, quite frankly, and 100 million tons of it still doesn't blow the lights out. So they went exploring in a 25 kilometer radius, and then they blew the lights out. They find the A4. And we were pretty, you know, I'm complimenting ourselves now, both in Galileo and African Pioneer. We were quick off the mark, and we got, shall I say, strategic licenses, which they might need. And of course, that's exactly what we've done in African Pioneer. And that's exactly what we've done in Galileo. And already they've explored the Galileo ones and the licenses they got, and when there's evidence of mineralization, we've done some exploration on ours, and in every case, we find the Dakar formation, which is where the mineralization occurred, and the marker bands, the carboniferous marker bands. So that's going to be a mine, no doubt about it. They put the ball mills in, they built most of the infrastructure, and I've got no doubt in my mind that the projects that we got will form feed for the future, yeah, for the future T3 mine. But also, license 251 and 3 may be big enough to be mines in their own rights. Yeah. The Sandfire geologists, the Sandfire management, the Sandfire board are very astute, very, very astute. And I think they see their original success growing into a regional play, and I don't think they're confining their, I can't speak for them, of course, but yeah, I don't think that management, that board, is confining their thinking to a single mine.
Yeah, I mean, they took 4 out of the 8, right? From what I remember, it was an option agreement where they paid the groups.
Yeah, that's right.
$500,000 cash, and then also there was an issuance of 107 million shares in Sandfire Resources, which were obviously issued to AFP. So, you know, they've committed, haven't they, in that respect? That was back in October.
Oh, they're committed, hook, line, and sinker. They'll be drilling shortly. They'll be drilling, and they'll be drilling in Galileo. Yeah, they'll be drilling, yeah. We did put a lot of pressure on them, because when they asked me what we wanted with the standard joint venture, I said, no, you know, the standard joint venture is a kiss of life. And what we did do, we made them, that sounds very rude. We put a requirement that there was significant expenditure in the first 2 years, i.e. $4 million.
Yeah.
And likewise, down at African Pioneer, they've got to spend, because the danger is when you do joint ventures with majors is they spread that first expenditure out over 4 or 5 years, and then the market gets totally bored.
Yeah.
And remember, when you do those standard joint ventures, you're on their timetable. You can't release anything. Yeah. We are to a certain degree now, but we put them behind the eight ball to spend quite a bit of money in a short time. And $4 million is quite a it's quite an hefty budget to spend on the properties.
So do you prefer an option agreement in this form of payment and issuance of shares, and then obviously a success payment built into that rather than a JV? Yeah,
that was my criteria. That, you know, we both, when we first started talking to Sandfire, both parties put a wish list down, and I said that every joint venture I've seen just about in this mining business, somebody ends up unhappy if the the major finds something, the junior gets basically diluted out of sight and ends up with a small royalty. If it doesn't quite meet up expectations in the first 2 or 3 years, the major gets fed up and up stumps and off he goes. And then sometimes it's not even disappointing results. So we don't like Botswana anymore. We don't like Vietnam anymore. We don't like Australia anymore. You know, they make decisions, boards do, and then management just have to up stumps and go. So you can't be tied to that, you know. So you've got to be able to get the project back. And if they don't perform, and I feel the arrangement we've got there with a deferred payment of up to $80 million in both cases is quite a nice exit for our shareholders if and when it happens. Imagine if you're drilling and you're looking at that deferred payment and you're looking at the general situation. Sometimes it's better to move fast than to wait. So you know, I think it allows for more combinations than there's more combinations of acquisition than the standard joint venture.
Moving on to Extract Resources, but staying in Africa, tell us a bit about what's happening there.
With Extract, well, gee whiz, that's, as you've noted, and it's there in the results, we've had a couple of decent quarters now of gold production from our small primary and our alluvials. And then the market is absolutely irritated to death with me, and I understand why, with the slowness of getting this Fairbride operation in. And I'm pleased to report that the plant is up and about ready. They've done a lot of cold turning and checking all the conveyors, checking all the apparatus. They're stripping the overburden. And it's my assessment, we're not very far now from producing. And what I can say is we've got a state-of-the-art plant, a very nice plant, and I look forward to some serious gold production starting over the next month and then building up in the first half and producing some very, very good income in the second half. So, yeah. Of course, the alluvials will keep going and the small hard rock will keep going. So I'm looking for some serious income from Mozambique in terms of gold. And likewise in Zambia, you know, we're working the Chongwe project. And Eureka has been hampered by the rains, but that too will start producing as soon as the pit starts drying out, hopefully towards the end of the month. So I'm looking towards serious income coming, as you say, park Australia to one side. But as a production company, Extract should be looking forward to some serious monthly revenue income.
Yeah, I mean, you had good results there from Manica in January, which was showing that your total mining gold production of 87.44 kilograms for the quarter, 2,811 ounces. So basically, Extract's part of that was 23.85 kilograms, or 767 ounces. And that was $1.383 million. And I presume that was when the price of gold was around the $1,700 mark.
That's right. We were getting, I think, around about $58 a gram. It's about during that period. And but, you know, when this next one comes in, we're getting 23.5%, and we're all open for 100 kilograms. So it's operating cash flow, 23.5%. So that's going to be a serious amount of money, Kevin.
Yeah. So it should be well in excess of $1.5 million then coming in each quarter if we're talking about 2,000 US dollar gold, which is roughly where we're at the minute.
Yeah, well, I'm still modest, you know. I think a solution, and we saw it on Friday night actually. I think a solution of the conflict, or a move towards the solution, i.e., ceasefires and drafting agreements, etc. I think I'm budgeting in my head a realistic gold price of 1750, 1800. for the rest of the year, and possibly down to 1650, which would make an awful lot of money. And remember, we haven't got any capital tied up there, Kevin. No capital tied up there. And we've got some tax losses as well. And our monthly monitoring costs are around about $70,000 to $80,000 by the time you finish. So it's a nice operation. We're going to, you know, we out of our income, we're going to start some more drilling there, because we're convinced the place hasn't been properly explored. That'll be a joint venture between ourselves and our partners. And so there we are. We've got a plant. It won't be a kiss of a, it won't be that big a problem to make a sulfide plant, so we can handle the more refractory material and transition zone to add on. So we should have a quite a nice long operation with an ability to find the source. I mean, we had our geologist on there, old Ed Slowey went there, and he said for a small area, he's never seen so many different mineralization types. And he's definitely of the opinion there's a big feeder down there somewhere. So there's a bit of head scratching going off on the geology. But in the meantime, I think we're going to be making some serious money.
The potential size of Firbride then in terms of gold is likely to be what? Give us an idea, even if it's not very accurate. Just
I'm going to say, I can't go making forward-looking statements, but, you know, we're thinking around about 100 kilograms of gold a month at the 100% level.
Okay, so it's going to be a similar situation to Manica itself.
Oh, much bigger. No. I mean, if Fairbride makes 100 kilos.
Ah, 100 kilos a quarter, sorry. Yes, sorry.
No, 100 kilos a month.
Yeah, no, but what I'm saying is Manica is 100 kilograms a quarter, you're hoping.
Oh, yeah, we'll do a month and what the rest of it does in a quarter.
Yeah.
So we can combine them together and our overheads aren't going to increase substantially. It's going to equate to quite a, you know, quite a big income, plus what we've got in Zambia in terms of Eureka and Chongwe and other small deposits we're looking at. Notwithstanding, So it's if you divide the company down the middle, and there are those who said we should have done and, you know, spun off a production company and just kept the raw exploration in Australia. I don't necessarily agree, because we'll be able to fund the exploration without placements. That's what I'm trying to do. It's a healthy looking company at 45, 50 million, isn't it?
We move on to the to Australia then, if we move out of Africa, and we're progressing towards this April, May time where you said there was going to be some announcements to do with the 2 million contained tons of copper. So what are we at in that situation?
Well, we're bang on target now. And of course, we had the racehorse project. We did a conceptual pit last year. And that conceptual pit at the time looked quite grandiose. That conceptual pit now looks quite underthought and underestimated. We've gone over the northwestern boundary wall, and the south just continues and continues and continues. We saw a little kink in the thing, and we're now almost goes due south. And then if you remember, we drilled 1.5 kilometers away to test some anomalies. And then we found this higher gold, a bit lower copper, which we called Ascot. And because it was so different geochemistry, it justified a different name and it got a different name. So we've got Racecourse, where I don't know whether it's going to be 500, 600, 700 million tons. And of course, the grades, you know, the assay results are coming in. And then what we're trying to do is get Racecourse even bigger, as big as we possibly can. And with Ascot, we're trying to demonstrate that Ascot is just completely open-ended. It's a massive block of rock. We want to demonstrate that it's got strike, and we want to actually apply some tons and grade to that. And the ambition, again, is to have a minimum of 2 million tons by that sort of order, April, May. Because, as you know, that's our requirement before we can even get in any discussions with the option, shall we call it, not, with the company who has the first right of refusal, Anglo American Corporation. So that's where we're all at. We're doing geophysics at the moment. We're on the third line. That geophysics will be tremendously helpful. It was the first round of geophysics was very helpful. But we was hampered actually in the first round because they wouldn't go letting us put the wires through the forest because the Australian New South Wales government, you know, the Forestry Commission were working in the forest. So that gave us a few gaps in the interpretation where we had to work on old Anglo information and new information, which was different orientations. Now we've pushing these lines, these geophysics lines through, and it's given us a picture as clear as the nose on your face. So that's helping a stack. We've got some applications for new pads because when you've got these porphyries, you know, we're not talking about a standard ore body. You're talking about something quite different. Plunge, you can plunge in all, you know, plunge this way, plunge that way, dip this way, dip that way, thicken, fatten, have stronger areas, have weaker areas. And, you know, they are very difficult animals to read. But we've learned now that the ore body is in the low resistivity. We've learned that there's a strong association between pyrrhotite and the chalcopyrite. We've learned that, of course, if you put the magnet, airborne magnetic surveys, that you could actually, the magnetic signature is subtle enough that you combine low resistivity and the magnetic influence to actually pinpoint where the strongest mineralization might be. So we've learned an awful lot in the last year, gents. We've learned an awful lot. So combination of these pads, new pads that we, once the government gives us permission to build them, targeted drilling should really upgrade Ascot and give us a bigger southern extension to the racecourse project. And of course, we're doing metallurgy now, and we're doing metallurgy up in Brisbane. And that metallurgy is going to tell us what sort of recovery we get for copper, what sort of recovery we get for gold, and if the moly might play, certainly at Ascot, the moly values are higher, moly might play a role at Ascot, unlikely to play a role at racecourse. So all of that is going on as we talk. That's scheduled for probably about the middle of April to end of April, the Met test work. So it really is going bang on target. We're happy with what we've got. The head scratcher at the moment really is racecourse. We know we extend. We know it seems to be orientated due south. We thought it went probably might be going quite a bit more west. Don't think it is anymore. The geochemistry of Ascot is wholly different from racecourse, so it is a different porphyry. But we're still scratching our head about what happens over that 1.25 kilometers. And we're feeling now, you know, that there's a hell of a chance that it's joined up and that the old thing thickens. And then that will obviously have to thicken to a fault, because how on earth would you have different chemistry over a continuous system? So it's quite obvious it's been faulted out, but not faulted out near racecourse, but faulted out quite a further down. So we may have a live 1.25 kilometers as well, or most of it live. So it's about as exciting as it gets. I start my day off with ringing the geologist, Quinton Hills, the project manager. I start off the day ringing with him and having a call with him. We talk it through. We talk where we've been. We talk where we're going. And quite frankly, you know, it's a finger biting exercise. But I don't know. Good Lord, how many holes have we drilled? And I don't think we've had a real bomber yet. You know, we've proved margins. The eastern margin, the northwestern margin seems to be. It seems to be now that we're getting to the end of the mineralization on the northwest. I think we're getting in central zone. We think we found the eastern limits of the ore body. But we sure haven't found the southern limits of the racecourse project, and the Ascot is completely open-ended. It could be as big as racecourse. So who wouldn't be excited? Who wouldn't be excited about this?
It sounds all very exciting. But the most interesting thing for me about Extract as a company, you know, doing just the basic sums, you're going to have probably EBITDA of anything from about $15 million to $20 million in gold once Fairbride gets up and running. And, you know, even on a conservative PE, let's say that's £10 million EBITDA, even on a conservative PE of, let's say, six, that's £60 million. Currently, your market cap is £44 million without even mentioning Australia.
That's right. Well, I mean, it's undervalued. Whichever side of the, you know, draw a line between production and exploration, it's in terms of where it sits in the world, the Australian activity, it's grossly undervalued, in my opinion. But then on pure fundamentals, i.e. numbers, again, the production is undervalued. You know, there's a big discount against its proper value on our production scenario, which is building. Mm-hmm. So if ever there was a company which has been overlooked, it's Xtract. Yeah. And, you know, people seem to sort of, you know, I go to the bulletin boards now and again, and I'm, you know, we count ourselves as very fortunate with the bulletin board at Xtract. Very informed, very knowledgeable subscribers. If there is debate, and that debate is sort of head-knocking debate, it's always done very professionally. People lie down to one another. People argue it through. It is really a great sight. But again, there doesn't seem to be that momentum to take it where it should be. And I don't know whether that's fear that Australia won't prove itself. Australia has proved itself if it stops this second. That the earnings won't come. The earnings are coming, as evidenced by the last quarterly report. And the fact that we'll have the pictures out soon, which shows that Fairbride is working, our first Zambian operation is working, and Eureka will be soon after when the rain draws out a bit. So I think the fear factor ought to be mitigated. You know, that there's so much happening in the company that the fear factor should be mitigated against.
Yeah, we've said it all along, haven't we, that Bush, we don't even think Bush Range is priced in, haven't we, Kev, on this whole thing? You know, just the alluvials alone underpin the current market cap and then some. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, well, we did hit 7.5p, I think it was, or maybe even a little bit higher less than a month ago. So it has definitely sank back, partly because of what's been happening geopolitically, but practically on a looking at the fundamentals of this company, if AFP is bizarre, this one is, I think, crazy.
Yeah, I guess that, you know, that's right. It's difficult to find the adjectives. I mean, you know, I think, as you say, in times of fear, and stay in pockets and don't move towards wallets. And I suppose that if you're looking at Xtract, you might think, well, Australia, you know, Colin Bird is always a little bit optimistic there. Maybe it's a year away, 2 years away. I'll wait for it to run. You know, that's almost understanding, but I ain't going to miss my targets.
Yeah, I think if what you says comes true, though, about this, hopefully, is some sort of ceasefire negotiation, sort of the end, you know, within the next sort of, you know, 7 to 10 days, which would be obviously the nicest thing for all of us and everybody, you know, everybody else. Then, in reality, I think there's going to be a sudden rush for some of these very, very small cap miners. Certainly, Xtract with revenue, you know, and EBITDAs and actual revenues coming in. That surely there's got to be some sort of re-rate on some of these stocks that are just languishing right down and unloved. Because for me, it's just, as Kev says, it's just crazy times.
I have never seen anything like it. And what confuses me is that, you know, the larger companies and the mid caps haven't taken anywhere near the beating that the small caps have made. So
larger caps, Colin, Yeah, Glencore hit an all-time high the other day. I mean, there was a few of them. They're all near all-time highs. You're certainly 52-week highs for sure. Because for some reason, the market sees that they have production and therefore it's straight to the bottom line. But with Xtract, that's the same thing. You know, you have got production of gold. You're about to increase that production as well. And you know, that's going to go straight to the bottom line.
I've led my life, Kevin, that sometimes, and, you know, it was true for many years, particularly with gold, that in actual fact, it was a converse, really. They didn't, the market really favoured the juniors in high prices because you were a call option for the particular commodity. And I do take your point that production from somebody like Anglo, Glencore, Rio that's real and might result and will result in dividends in 3 months' time, six, you know, your annual and quarterly dividend, 6 monthly quarterly dividends. But generally, we've always been seen as at this end of the market, we've always been seen as a call option for the commodities. So the commodities now are forecast higher than any one of them have been for years. Look at tin, look at lithium, look at cobalt, look at copper, look at nickel. You know, there's not zinc. Even zinc is over 4,000. You know, these are metals which languished at 800 to 1,200 for years is zinc. So here we sit now with these metals all forecast, and there's a reticence, there's a reluctance to actually get in there as a call option to when these, you know, the geopolitical tensions subside. And then we live in this real world of growth. Armageddon's gone. Armageddon's gone. Mankind is prospering. The emerging world is looking for the new fridges, is looking for the new products, is looking for the cars, is looking for clean planet. Gee whiz, if ever there was a time, if ever was a time to get into these companies as pure call options to their future, then now's the time. And you know, I'm not a youngster, and I don't think I've ever lived in times like I am now, with the potential for the all of a sudden to be a rapid turnaround in the fortunes of the juniors, that it will virtually be unsustainable. What I'm trying to say is that we, instead of having a 3 month run, there'll be such a turnaround that the majors will be taking, will be acquiring the more advanced assets, and the newer ones won't be coming through because they've yet to be found. And I think that we're going to sit in a period. So when I talk about sustainability, will we juniors, the pioneers, be able to sustain the progress to supply the feed to the majors? Because you've got to remember, the majors have not got exploration departments any longer. They've got new business departments. They buy success and ignore failure. And traditionally, yeah, now, for 15 years, the junior market has been the providers of the discoveries to make the big mines. You know, I mean, I'm quite proud of the fact that I discovered Sentinel, which is now the 14th biggest mine in the world. It's a nice thing to have under your belt. You know, where's the project generation coming from? A lot of these things you're seeing nowadays are old chestnuts, which have been around. You know, there were dogs 10 years ago, and they're still dogs. You know, a great market doesn't make a dog into a racehorse, you know.
But when you look at all your companies, you've got African Pioneer, potentially sort of 8,000 tons, maybe even 8,000 tons, potentially 20,000 tons of copper per annum. You've got Caris Minerals and yourself in Cyprus, certainly 8,000 tons, hopefully, per annum next year. You've got Extract Resources with, you know, the large quantities of gold, and then potentially a huge project in Australia. And then you've got the same sort of prospects also in Galileo with huge quantities of copper, tonnage of copper per annum possible. So when you add all that up, we are going to call you Mr. Copper. And I think ultimately, if you follow these four stocks, I don't think you'll go too far wrong, because ultimately they're going to be producing within a year to 18 months in many cases. And in the case of the Australian asset in Extract, probably going to be sold, you know, the for sale sign's going to be up there for some major to come in and do the business. So, you know, the potential, regardless of the price of copper, is going to be huge, absolutely huge. The EBITDA that these companies are going to create going forward is going to be massive. But you mentioned one thing, Colin, which has taken us off the subject. You mentioned a dog doesn't turn into a racehorse. But you told us the last time you were buying a racehorse. So how's it doing?
The best one I've got is he's showing a lot of metal. He's showing a lot of good work. And
I hope you called it copper or something of that.
No, I called it Star Zinc. I called it Star Zinc, actually.
Star Zinc.
So watch out for that one when the racing season starts in April.
Now we've actually put the world to rights. It's been a very interesting conversation. I just want to thank you for your time. It's always very interesting having these kind of like round table chats, isn't it?
Yeah, I enjoy it.
Thanks again. Yeah.
Thanks, gents. Thank you very, very much. All the very best.
Thank you, Colin.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.